Jews knew how to survive, and now we've returned. Do you know how Jews still survive? They survive in the text. The art of composing is one that comes through some kind of nearly divine channel, divine inspiration, but it's depicted as the immediate, intense reaction to pain and loss and anxiety and suffering. That, at least, is the art of writing for Agnon. Everything about him, from his name to his date of birth to the date of his aliyah, his arrival in the land of Israel, everything was mythologized. Everything was part of the fable the author crafts about his own identity. Creativity, in all its forms, is the most authentic Jewish response to pain, to catastrophe, to exile, to destruction. Last week, I made reference to Thomas Wolfe's You Can't Go Home Again in the context of Agnon's wonderful novel, Oreach Natal Alun, A Guest for the Night. The idea that you can't return, that you can't step back into the river, that the shock of being alienated in your own home is disorienting, is horrifying, is nightmarish. And we spoke about that briefly last week. And this week, one of my students, Rivka Kraus, sent me a very evocative quote from the American poet Maya Angelou. Angelou writes in her small book, Letter to My Daughter, Thomas Wolfe warned, in the title of America's great novel, that you can't go home again. I enjoyed the book, but I never agreed with the title. I believe that one can never leave home. I believe that one carries the shadows, the dreams, the fears and dragons of home under one's skin, at the extreme corners of one's eyes, and possibly in the gristle of the earlobe. I think very much Angelou here puts her finger on something that I was trying to get at last week. Indeed, on something that Agnon is getting at in his novel. We really can't go home, but we can't go home because we also never leave. Home is with us, and it's the ghost, the haunting of the home we left behind that occupies us, which makes it impossible to ever recapture. That brings us directly into tonight's theme as we explore a collection of 20 short stories called Sefer HaMa'asim, or The Book of Deeds. I'll talk about that title momentarily. But it's important to remember that while stories such as the fable of the goat, which we saw a few weeks ago, certainly the bridal canopy, and even in its own way, A Guest for the Night, which is a much more modern story, a story set much closer to our own era, the power of all of these stories lies in Agnon's ability to conjure a world of old Jewish tradition, and in many cases, of the distant past. This collection, Book of Deeds, the Sefer HaMa'asim, in Hebrew, it's collected, these 20 short stories are collected in a volume called Samuch V'Nireh. I'll come back to that momentarily. But these 20 stories in the Book of Deeds draws his readers into the thicket of the complexity of what it means to confront modernity. With the arrival of these short stories, mid-career, I should mention, Agnon was finally understood to be at once a deeply traditional writer and a distinctly modern author. Israeli literary critic Gershon Shaked felicitously observed that Agnon was revealed as a revolutionary traditionalist, although reversing that noun and adjective would produce an equally accurate, if mirrored, title. He was both a revolutionary traditionalist and a traditional revolutionary. The 20 stories in the collection were first published in periodicals at different times over a span of almost 20 years, from the early 1930s to the early 1950s. And they were then collected in Hebrew in the volume Samuch V'Nireh. In English, the translations are parceled out between two different volumes, a book that was lost and The Outcast. In the appendix to The Outcast, I explain the history of the publication of the stories, and I give a kind of reader's guide to how somebody could go about putting the translations back together into an order that approximates what one would experience in reading them in Hebrew. Interestingly, Agnon does not organize them chronologically in the order in which they were published. The title, The Book of Deeds, Ma'asim, calls into question a world where man's deeds, where man's actions, are not always sufficient to accomplish his task. But as we've seen so often, ma'asim means two different things. Agnon is transmitting on two different channels. Ma'asim are the deeds and actions of mankind, but ma'asim, or in the Yiddish inflection, meisim, meiseloch, a chassidische meise, a Hasidic tale. So the English title could equally have been called A Book of Stories or A Book of Tales. Many have correctly or incorrectly observed that these are Agnon's surrealistic stories. Surrealism, of course, is the 20th century avant-garde movement in art and architecture and music and film and, of course, literature, which aimed to tap into the unconscious and its conflict with the conscious mind. And this results in very often bizarre depictions of reality, filtered through irrational juxtapositions of different phenomena. These are marked by a sense of being unmoored, of being unnerved, things that defy logic, non-linear plots, things that don't conform to reality as we know and experience it in our normal world. A world, we see a world that's lacking clear causality. As you probably saw in the sample stories that we sent, this leads to a blurring of boundaries. It's not clear the boundary between life and death. We encounter characters, like the narrator's grandfather, who we know to be dead, but he appears to us in the world of the plot of the story as if he is alive, but he is not a ghost, right? The appearance of a ghost does not make for surrealism, right? In a world where there might be ghosts, a ghost is real. Fairy tales are not surreal because the action in the fairy tale conforms to the rules of nature as given within that story. But to encounter someone who is dead, who is interacting with us in this world, even though we know him to be perfectly no longer a member of our world, is surreal. The blurring of boundaries of time, that time doesn't move linearly, right? The liminal spaces between passages of time, particularly the passages between secular time and holy time. Space. A story can begin in Jerusalem, and suddenly the narrator is walking the streets of Buchach or of Germany, but without having gone through some kind of magic cave. Anybody who remembers their dreams is familiar with these types of phenomena. And indeed, some have observed, Gershom Scholem among them, that these stories may very well have originated in Agnon's own actual dreams. In the manuscript pages that we have in the archives, in fact, some of the stories are initially titled Chalom, or dream. And this gives rise to the dreamlike, or indeed nightmarish, elements that are in many of these stories. The most well-known exemplars of surrealism in art and in literature, of course, are Salvador Dali and Franz Kafka. Dali's Persistence of Memory from 1931, the image you see at the bottom left of the screen, which by the way, was painted exactly at the same time that Agnon is beginning to compose the stories in this collection. The surreal is especially because we don't know the meaning of our ma'asim, of our deeds. And we also don't know or can't understand the meaning of the ma'asim and the deeds that are being acted upon us. Why does Gregor Samsa wake up one morning as a bug? Why is Joseph K. accused? And for what crime? We never know. Of course, in all of these stories, the presence of the unconscious is front and center. And of course, we can't discuss the unconscious, particularly not in stories and art and literature that are brought about at that particular time in Europe and in the land of Israel, without, of course, immediately going to our friend Sigmund Freud and psychoanalysis. All of these movements, combined with the horrors of World War I, no doubt gave rise to surrealism. While the stories of the Sefer HaMa'asim are quote-unquote Kafkaesque in tone, the enigmatic short stories were mistakenly thought to be influenced by Kafka, a fact which overlooks a claim that overlooks the simple fact that Agnon had already been writing in surrealistic or nightmarish styles even before his departure for Europe in 1908, well before Kafka was known in Prague, let alone in Buchach or in Yafo or in Jerusalem. Agnon made a claim that he hardly knew any of Kafka's writings, and what he had read was, quote, foreign to his soul. There's a well-known anecdote in Beit Agnon where we have a full set of Kafka's writings, both in the original German, of course, and in Hebrew translation. A visitor points to these well-worn volumes and says, Agnon, I thought you said you'd never read Kafka. And Agnon looks at the books and says, those must be my wife's. The point is that comparison, the fact that two things may look alike, does not necessarily testify to the influence of one on the other. The comparison to Kafka begs the question not of its historicity, but of its usefulness. Professor Arnold Band, the very important scholar of Agnon and of Hebrew literature, points out that such a comparison is entirely misleading because, quote, the reference in a Kafka story rarely belong to a single tradition, unlike the symbols in Agnon, which almost always point within the canon of Jewish tradition. Band suggests that a better comparison would be to Dante, whose symbolism is not merely a private method of grasping reality, nor is it simply a literary device. In Dante, as well as in Agnon, symbols are palpably religious ones transferred into literature. Agnon's accomplishment in doing this is even more remarkable even than Dante, when we consider that he had the harder task of writing for an audience, a Hebrew audience, a Jewish audience, in the first half of the 20th century, at a time in which all of those references were part of a tradition very much in flux. Nevertheless, the reference to Kafka does help us orient ourselves around these stories. And I must confess that when I first encountered Agnon's stories as a high school student, long before I would have been able to make my way through Agnon in Hebrew, and even had I been able to make my way through Agnon in Hebrew, all of his references to the rabbinic and biblical canon would have been completely lost on me. But nevertheless, even as an adolescent reader, I had recognized certain points of intersection with Kafka. And our image-poor minds will summon up from the database of our memories different types of images. Gershom Scholem observed that Agnon was just as likely influenced not by Kafka, but by the tales of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, an influence which would have lent them the same so-called Kafkaesque aura, although it should have been called Nachmanesque. The fact that Kafka got to put his name on the genre just means he brought it to a level of perfection, not that he invented it. In fact, Kafka himself had been influenced by the tales of Rabbi Nachman, which he read in Martin Buber's translations. When this type of writing becomes agnonized or Judaized, the genre takes up a whole set of particularistic questions. Questions that convey doubts and confusion about the pious tradition, a Jew who is intellectually a citizen of the Western world, but yet still rooted in certain sources. And this gives rise to a profoundly new and modern situation and set of questions. But it also intensifies the contradictions because that Jew, so depicted in the stories, is more aware of what's at stake. He's more conscious and more sensitive to the cost of what gets left behind: purity and wholeness, and not just the observance of the tradition, but the values and the virtue that comes through living such a life and such a tradition, which becomes no longer viable given the modern condition. The stories are almost all marked by a perturbed and ambiguous or frustrated ending. While all of the stories in this cycle, all 20 stories, share introspection as the predominant point of view, their thematic range includes a variety of angles. Among these are sickness, physical sickness, but spiritual sickness. And the physical sickness is usually a symbol or a stand-in for some kind of spiritual infirmity and the search for its cure. The need for self-purification, self-incrimination, the loss of home, the loss of personal identity, social alienation, the terrors of the bureaucratic society that was very well depicted by Wells in the trial, and the simple shock of being, again, of being unmoored from tradition, of being the fish out of the water of the Jewish life that had defined our society for so many centuries. In the stories, there's obviously a quasi-autobiographical element. There's a confessional element that's being conveyed through the story's narrative inner monologue, what Arnold Band called the dramatized ego. And again, here I should just acknowledge my debt to Professor Band, both for his interest in my work, but more so for his groundbreaking work, which has informed much of my reading of these stories. And I do commend to you his work, Nostalgia and Nightmare, which is unfortunately out of print, but widely available secondhand online and in other locations. When the first stories of the Book of Deeds began to appear in periodicals in the early 30s, both the critics and the general public were shocked. They didn't know what to make of these stories. Suddenly, the master of the pious tale, the teller of the stories of the old Jewish world, was grazing in foreign fields. He seemed to be indulging in modernistic, Western Europeanized forms and mannerisms and writing. The outrage was compounded because the implications of this new mode ran against the grain of contemporary Zionist ideology, which saw the Hebrew folktale, both in its Hasidic and general garb, as the authentic cultural expression of the Jewish nationalist sentiments. In other words, in adopting the obviously westernized, obviously Europeanized form of storytelling, Agnon was bucking the expectation of his audience, and they didn't like it initially. they wanted more stories like the fable of the goat. And instead, they got stories that reminded them of Kafka. That comparison agitated Agnon to no end. It was only about a decade after these stories started appearing that the Israeli critic Baruch Kurzweil helped the audience understand what Agnon was doing. And only then did they begin to find an appreciative audience. At that point, a new image of Agnon emerged and began to form itself in the reader's imagination. And Agnon transformed from being the master of the pious old world tale into a highly complex modern writer. He was as much an existentialist as he was a folklorist, and indeed, probably a great deal more. Once apprised so shockingly of the power of the nightmare in these surrealistic or non-realistic short stories, the critics then re-examined everything he had been doing for 20 years. They went back to stories like The Bridal Canopy and The Fable of the Goat, and they reread it through a more sophisticated lens and discovered that Agnon's modernism was present in those old world stories as well. Indeed, our reading here in our course of those old world stories, which try to show how profoundly modern they were, is influenced by the fact that we come after, that we know to read Agnon as a modernist. But that's not how the stories were necessarily originally absorbed and consumed in the 19-teens and 20s and 30s. And the appearance of these modernistic tales led to a complete reevaluation of everything Agnon was doing. In the stories, both the samples that we sent, and in fact, this is true for all 20 stories in the collection, we meet this hypersensitive, often neurotic first-person narrator who we can be forgiven for thinking is a stand-in for the autobiographical Shai Agnon. There's a mix of memory, nostalgia, fantasy, dream, nightmare, often with high anxiety and kinds of anxiety dreams, that sense of being unprepared, dreams that we probably have all experienced, although maybe not since we took the SATs or something. The kind of anxiety dream that you know that you show up for the exam unprepared. You show up in school not knowing that the big exam was today. Or you show up at work to walk into the office waiting for everyone to make your presentation and you realize that you've forgotten your PowerPoint at home, or you were unaware you were supposed to be presenting something, or the other variation of this dream where you get up in the morning and you go about your business and you get ready to go to work and you get in your car and you drive to the office and you walk in only to discover that you are completely unclothed and you'd forgotten to put your clothes on. These are all variations of common anxiety dreams. And the related dream of impeded motion. You're trying to do something. Someone is chasing you, a bandit, a wild animal, and you're trying to run, but you're like on a treadmill. You can't make any motion, right? You're trying to achieve something. You want to catch the last bus, the title of one of the stories in this collection. And you're running for it. You're running for it. Your feet are flapping on the ground, but you can't make any motion. You're boarding a ship to head off on a sea voyage with your family and your children. And suddenly you realize the horror that every parent experiences at some point of their life, that your children are missing. Where are they? Where did they go? Right? The idea that the ship is about to sail and maybe your children are not with you and you have to run to catch them, but you can't make any motion. Well, these are all ideas, of course, that Sigmund taught us about. Right? If we look at the interpretation of dreams, Freud's great work, it's as if Agnon lifts the ideas straight off its pages. And indeed, in Jerusalem in the 1930s, Freud's school was quite prominent. Freud had a number of disciples that had made their way to Jerusalem and set up the Israeli branch of psychoanalysis, and these ideas were very au courant in the world in which Agnon lived, and at Beit Agnon we also have copies of Freud's works. In The Interpretation of Dreams, Freud writes, "What is signified by the sensation of impeded movement, which so often occurs in the dream, and which is so closely allied to anxiety? One wants to move and is unable to stir from the spot, or one wants to accomplish something and meets one obstacle after another. The train is about to start, and one cannot reach it. One's hand is raised to avenge an insult, and its strength fails, etc." It is convenient but inadequate to answer that there is motor paralysis in sleep. Now, as Freud speculates from a physiological point of view, the reason we have these dreams is because when we're sleeping, we don't control our motor functions, and the brain is reflecting something that's happening in the body. You know, the dream that people very often have that you're trying to scream and nothing comes out, by the way, reminiscent of that other great surrealistic work, Munch's The Scream. You're trying to scream and nothing will come out of your mouth. And sometimes in the dream you're unable to scream, but in actual physiological reality you are screaming in your sleep until your spouse elbows you in the ribs, or sometimes you wake your own self up from the sound of the scream you're issuing in real life, but which in the dream you were unable to emit from your mouth. In other dreams, which involve failure to accomplish a thing, not only as a situation, but also as a sensation, the same contradiction is more emphatically expressed in the form of a volition, of a will, of a desire to do something, to which a counter-volition opposes itself. Thus, the sensation of impeded motion represents a conflict of will. If we take Freud at his word, it's unimportant whether Freud is right or wrong. This is what Freud said. And these are the words that no doubt were in the air when Agnon was writing his stories. The sense of impeded motion is a representation on the part of the dreamer or the storyteller for a conflicted will, for a sense not just of anxiety, but lack of clarity, of confusion, of disparate desires that are in conflict. And if you go back to the stories that we suggested you read, you might see that that is, in fact, the case. In the stories of the Sefer HaMaasim, we're almost always introduced to the story within a specifically Jewish context, a very specifically Jewish milieu. Very often, it's on holy days. The story is set on the eve of Rosh Hashanah, on the eve of Yom Kippur, late in the afternoon of Yom Kippur, when one is trying to finish the spiritual work of that day, on the eve of Passover. You don't need to be a Freudian to understand that in a lot of Jewish homes, there's a certain amount of anxiety on Erev Pesach, on the eve of Shabbat, these types of liminal times between Kodesh and Chol, between the sacred and the secular. The attempt to accomplish any small task or deed or ma'aseh becomes an overwhelming Sisyphean challenge. Whether it's to mail a letter, to catch the last bus, to order a meal, to get to synagogue in time for the service, to grab your talit and go off to pray, to take a bath, to visit the doctor, to have a document stamped in a government office, or just simply to go to your father's house, there's no chance, once the task is initiated, that the narrator will accomplish his goal. So, for example, a story like Pi Shnayim, in translation as twofold, it's Yom Kippur. It's Agnon's most complete treatment of the theme, of the challenge of tshuva, of repentance. Each Yom Kippur becomes the accumulation of all previous Yemei Kippur. But it's also impacted by the potential and the challenge of all Yom Kippurs that will come in the future. So there's this kind of flittering of memory and this breaking down of linear time from present to past to future and back to the present again. The story ends with the narrator speculating. Sometimes it seems as if I am standing on Yom Kippur at nightfall, as the gates are closing and the day's soul is about to depart, and a day which passes cannot be returned. Yom she'over eino chozer. And then the narrator ends, the end, but not of heaven's mercies. There is always hope, even though he knows he has not achieved his spiritual goal on this particular Yom Kippur. A story like Pat Shlema, in English as a whole loaf, which is perhaps the most characteristic and also the most widely read and researched of the stories in this collection. If you have time to only read one of the stories we sent, I recommend A Whole Loaf. It's a symbolic quest. Dr. Yekutiel Ne'eman sends the narrator on a job to mail letters. It was immediately observed when the story appeared that Yekutiel Ne'eman is somehow a stand-in or a symbol for Moses. In the Midrashic literature, Yekutiel is a name that's ascribed to Moses, to Moshe, and Ne'eman, trustworthy, is of course a biblical description of his personality. So if the Moses character gives the narrator a packet of letters to mail, the narrator is now in the position of having received the commandments from Moses. And this symbol of mailing the letters is conflicted with the inevitable distraction. In almost every single story, the narrator is off to accomplish his task, but something or someone gets in his way. In this story, it happens to be twofold. It's his hunger. He wants to order a meal. And at the meal, he wants to eat a whole loaf, which may be symbolic of perfection, of integrity, of completeness, of other ritual obligations. But of course, he can't do it. Instead, we're given a grotesque scene in a restaurant where, it's a combination scene from Kafka or indeed from Dante with something out of the Marx Brothers, as waiters go topsy-turvy and food and mice are tossed all around. The inevitable distraction also presents itself in the person of Mr. Gressler. In Agnon, very often we must pay attention to the symbolic meanings of names. In this case, the German Gressler, Mr. Frightening, who represents anxiety and serves to get the narrator off track, and in fact nothing is fulfilled. At the end, neither his task that he received from Dr. Yekutiel Ne'eman nor the meal that he is seeking to eat, nothing is achieved. He can't satisfy his obligations, and neither can he satisfy his hunger. The hunger itself was the distraction, and of course hunger serves as a very rich symbol for all types of distractions, and hunger serves as a very weighted symbol, and of course has given rise to very many psychosexual interpretations of the story. But you don't need to be Sigmund Freud to unpack what this might mean. Take, for example, the duet of very short stories To Father's House and To the Doctor, which treat, you know, kind of overlapping themes. They both feature this need to kind of get across a bridge. I'll come back to the symbolism of a bridge momentarily, but the narrator has to get across the bridge to find the doctor who will come and heal both father and young sister who are afflicted with some kind of unnamed illness. Father, of course, is very easily a symbol of authority, of tradition, of the home. Father, of course, as we mentioned in an earlier context, father is also a symbol of Father in heaven, the ultimate source of authority. In which case, what does it mean that he appears in this story as being bedridden with illness? What does it mean in the story To Father's House that the narrator returns to his hometown and cannot find his way home? Like we saw in the non-surreal novel A Guest for the Night, the homecoming is fraught with anxiety. It's a great challenge, and it's very disturbing to know that everything has changed, even the space between the houses, the narrator told us last week. But yet, I'm perfectly familiar with everything. That idea of being presented with something so familiar that you know it as you know yourself, and to recognize that it bears no resemblance, neither the physical resemblance nor the spiritual and symbolic meaning of everything bears no resemblance to your memories of it from youth. So what does it mean that the narrator returns home to Father's house and cannot find home and doesn't know where Father is? Agnon presents us with these challenges and these questions. We'll look now at one final story, an extraordinarily short story in Hebrew, Hanerot, or The Candles. It's a 1932 story. It's very early in this cycle of stories. And it begins right at the onset of Shabbat, with the narrator caught at the last minute, confronted with fear. Is it too late? Am I on time for Shabbat? The story is compact in the extreme. All 6 days of creation, meaning the 6 days of the week, I was busy and had no time to bathe. On Friday afternoon, I freed myself of my affairs. I took clean white garments and went to the sea to bathe. This is a typically mundane activity common to all of the other, the very simple idea that he wants to bathe before the onset of the Sabbath. But it becomes mission impossible. According to the template of these stories, it's inevitable that he'll be confronted with some distraction. In this case, an encounter with someone named Mr. Chaim Apropos. He leads the narrator away from his purpose, and the reader is left with a very inconclusive conclusion. This character, Mr. Chaim Apropos, who encounters Pagabi, is a reference, no doubt, to the Talmud in Masechet Kiddushin, which describes the minuval, that scoundrel or that rascal who Rashi identifies as none other than the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. You know, like in the cartoons, you remember there'd be a little devil on your shoulder opposite a little angel whispering conflicting instructions to, well, Daffy Duck or whomever it was in the cartoon. That's the Jewish idea of the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. He's the Satan. He is the devil. Satan means the one who distracts, who causes us to go off course. That's his job in the Jewish tradition. The name Chaim Apropos means, symbolically, it means something like a life unintentional, a life lived without purpose, an incidental life. That is, after all, the definition of what the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, is. It distracts us from our intentionality, from our purpose. The whole story takes place at this intersection, the commingling of holiness and profanity at the onset of Shabbat, at this Bein Hashmashot, the late afternoon, where, at least within the halachic tradition, we're not even sure, is this the end of the previous day or the beginning of the Sabbath? And therefore, we treat it stringently in all cases, but Bein Hashmashot means it's this kind of time which is commingled together. Safek Yom v'Safek Laila. We're unsure whether it's Friday, the weekday, or whether or not it is already Shabbat and holy with all of its rituals and restrictions. It's the borderland between holy and profane. The narrator follows Apropos into some kind of house that he says he's never been to. But in the house, Shabbat has already been prepared, even though he can see out the window that it is not yet Shabbat there. But even though Shabbat has already been prepared, or it may appear that Shabbat has already entered here in the home, there are people that are occupied with weekday affairs. There's a bookseller displaying his wares. Volumes written in Samaritan, this foreign language of the Shomronim, the Samaritans that appear in the books of the prophets. The narrator cannot read Samaritan, but yet he discovers that they are his own writings, as well as other things he's thought to write, but hadn't succeeded in doing so because his pen could not capture them. Nevertheless, these writings and thoughts have been translated into that language, which he doesn't understand, but nevertheless recognizes that these are his own writings, the writings he has done, and the writings he has considered. He hasn't actually written them yet, but somehow they've been captured in this foreign language, and quite surprisingly, he's able to recognize them as his own. Well, at this point, the image, it's not a ghost, but the image of his grandfather, his disapproving, pious, bearded grandfather appears, a la the image of his father of the Talmud and Sota that appears before Joseph in the house of Potiphar and saves him from sin. Mr. Apropos disappears. The narrator tries to adjust four candles that are tipping in their holders, for he's fearful that they will spill over and cause a fire and light the shulchan and mapa, the table and the tablecloth. But he makes a mess of it. He mashes the candles down, the wax is melting, and the candles break in his hands. With Sabbath about to begin, he's reminded that he wants to get down to the seashore to take a bath. He makes his way there, where the water stands like a wall, which is an obvious reference to the splitting of the Red Sea. And there are people in a whole variety of states of undress standing around in puddles caused by low tide. He doesn't know where to put his clean clothing down, because wherever he will place it, it will become dirtied, and then he will have not achieved what he wanted to, which was to become cleansed and ready for the Sabbath. He goes up onto a bridge, which, I mean, to me it sounds like some kind of jetty or a bridge to nowhere jutting out into the sea, from which he hopes to jump into the water. At this point, the bridge starts quaking and trembling, and the story ends. Now, the bridge symbol, which appears in very many of these stories, I presume is a reference. We needn't go to Freud for what happens when you dream of bridges. We have a Talmudic reference. And if we take Professor Band at his word, we should always look inside. We should always return to the home base to try to unpack the symbols. The Talmud in Masechet Shabbat asks, when is a person examined? When is God checking to see whether we've been naughty or nice? When are we vulnerable to judgment and held accountable for our actions? You know, we spoke a minute ago about Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is a day of judgment, but judgment is not reserved for one day a year. That we're judged all the time. But we're not judged at all times all the time. There are certain moments where, you know, a pop quiz is administered to see, you know, what status we're at. So the Talmud suggests, in the name of Reish Lakish, when we're crossing a bridge calls judgment down onto us. You can understand why a bridge might be such a symbol for such a thing, a passage between two places. A bridge is also, I guess, inherently a dangerous structure, and therefore, when we're undergoing some danger, it's a good time for a little self-inspection. So the Gemara says, only when you're crossing a bridge and no other time? Rather, anything like a bridge, any place where danger is commonplace. So what is a bridge? A bridge in our symbolism is a place in which we are examined, a place in which we are called to task. And the presence of the bridge, and the idea that the story ends on this quaking, shaking bridge to nowhere with no ending, with this indeterminate, unclear, we don't know what happens any more than we know what happens to Joseph K. at the end of the trial. Like so much of Agnon's writings, this story has a meta-artistic theme. The artist is thinking and writing about the nature of his craft, that his own writings appear to him in this foreign language, in this Shomroni, in the Samaritan language, gets at the crux of the question, is his writing, and here I'll fall into the trap of saying Agnon's writing. I'll fall into the trap of assuming the narrator is Agnon himself, being autobiographical, but I've warned you about the limits of that. Is his writing a holy creation or a secular, profane form of art? After all, the Samaritans of the biblical prophets are they who are both fearing of the Lord, yet they worshipped graven images. That's a verse from the second book of Kings, chapter 17. The Shomronim were not Jews, but they were not exactly Gentiles. They had partially joined the nation, but not fully, because they could not give up their idolatry completely. What does that mean? What does it mean to write of the Jewish experience, drawing on the sources of Judaism, which we've spent the last 5 weeks examining? What does it mean to do that? To ask the most profound questions of Jewish life, using the sources of Jewish tradition, but cast into the mold of modern literature. The symbolism of Samaritan is something which is, as they say in Yiddish, nicht dahin, nicht daher, not here, not there, neither fish nor fowl. We don't know exactly which box to put it in. This is a story about the borderlands, the twilight zone between holy and profane. And the author, the narrator, sees his own work and works that he hasn't even yet succeeded in writing translated into this twilight zone-ish language. And it raises essential questions about what he's doing. Mr. Apropos distracts our narrator in his attempt to achieve purification, which perhaps might be repentance. The narrator tries to safeguard the shulchan and the mapah, the table and the tablecloth. Again, one need not be a great Talmudist to unpack these symbols as the Shulchan Aruch and the mapah, the commentary of Rav Yosef Karo, these most important 16th century halachic codes. But he makes a mess of it. When he's reminded that his chance to reach the sea and to achieve purification, repair, tikkun, it's slipping away. And we're not sure whether he makes it or not. The scene on the seashore, which is a parody of the miracle of the splitting of the Red Sea, leaves the narrator wavering on a bridge between holiness and profanity on one side, and between holiness and purity on one side, and the secular, unclad folk on the shore. It's grotesque. It's a scene almost right out of one of the departments of hell in Dante. We don't have time to unpack every single symbol, even if we had the capability to do it, even in this very, very short story. But we're presented with the image of a writer caught between tradition and modernity, between observance and secularism, between sacred and profane, confronted with the most pressing existential questions about the nature of his own literary creation and his own spiritual life. And he's standing on a very narrow, shaky bridge between the two worlds that he inhabits. In Agnon's great posthumous novel, Shira, we encounter a character named Chemdat. Chemdat is a minor character that has cameo roles across the whole canon of Agnon's writings and was widely understood to be Agnon's most autobiographical figure. He's a young Galician Jew of the Second Aliyah period who arrives from Buchach in Yafo, just like his creator. And one of the other characters observes, today's reader is no longer content with reading for pleasure. He expects to find a new message in every work. And the writer Chemdat, channeling the author Agnon, replies, I didn't come to answer the question, where are you going? Though I do sometimes answer the question, where did you come from? Today's readers of Agnon, you and I, are reminded that we too are still on the shaky bridge. We're caught in the modern world between past and future, between where we're coming from and where we're going, between Kodesh and Chol, sacred and secular. Many Agnon critics point out that his work is preoccupied with the questions of, is it too late to go back, to return, to repent, to repair? This is certainly true, but at the same time, as we saw with Thomas Wolfe and Maya Angelou's alternate reading, he's also asking, not only can we go back, but can we ever leave? Have we ever left? And if we leave, does it leave us? Indeed, we are remaining caught on the shaky bridge. But by answering the question, where did we come from, Agnon helps us. He helps his readers. He helps contemporary Jews and others consider these questions. Where are we going? And how we each might find our own way back, as well as forward, as modern readers and as thinking spiritual beings. The ending of the story, The Candles, like almost every other story in this collection, is indeterminate. We don't know how it ends, leaving the narrator swaying on the bridge. For there can be no ending. We must each write one for ourselves.